Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Ryan, and I'm an AmeriCorps member serving as the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds. In today's episode, we'll have part two of our Intro to Forest Bathing and feature an interview with Certified Forest Therapy Guide, Sari Telpner. As always, I'd like to begin with a land acknowledgement to recognize the indigenous groups who inhabited this land for generations and took care of the Umpqua Watershed before white settlers arrived. These groups include Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Malala, and others. My guest today is Sari Telpner. She is a certified ANFT forest therapy guide and health educator. What does forest bathing entail, and where did it originate?
Thanks, Ryan, for having me here. So in the 1980s, the whole country of Japan was having a health crisis. People were working like 12-hour days, 20-hour days. They were really working, and they were in office buildings. They were inside, no fresh air, no windows at times. And people were having heart attacks and strokes and depression and suicides. And the government of Japan saw this as being a crisis. And they developed these forests. They called them healing forests. And they developed this practice called Shinrin Yoku, which literally translates to bathing in the essence of the forest. And as part of the work they did, they would bring people for the weekend to these sites in nature. And before they would take them out for a 3-hour walk, they would do things like take blood pressure before they went in on the experience. And they would also do like take samples of people's spit, like a spit test to test their cortisol, their stress hormone levels. And what they found was people would come out of these experiences with blood pressure that was, you know, much closer to normal and more balanced, and cortisol levels that were back to normal. And so they started doing studies on this. So that's where it started coming from. And they were doing this, you know, this was happening also in South Korea. And I think forms of this have happened around the world probably for generations, but Japan was the first nation really to be making it a healing, you know, working with it as a healing well-being modality.
That's neat. Yeah, I think I've heard that some doctors are now like prescribing time in nature. Is that correct?
They are. There is a program called Parks RX, and there's a whole map that it's all set up, you know, through the web, where a doctor who's connected with the Parks RX program can actually look up all the different parks in their city, and they can write a prescription for their patients and send them, oh, look, there's a park here, and you can spend, they write down the prescription as, you know, 30 minutes in nature 4 times a week, something like that. And it's really happening. It's a happening thing, and doctors are getting on board. And one of ANFT has actually a medical director who is a doctor in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and she's really into working with, you know, this with her patients and getting them into nature. And she does, it's not something she just does and tells them to do it. It's like, it's part of her life too, immersing in nature for well-being.
Why did you first get involved and become a forest therapy guide?
Well, it was a little surprising to me in some ways, but not surprising. I had, I have my bachelor's degree in health promotion and fitness and a master's degree in health education. And from there I went on and became a credentialed whole health educator. And I was working with clients, and in my own life, I had had several years ago, I had had a health crisis, and it affected me at every level. Because when you're having a physical problem, it affects you at the mental and emotional level. And during that period, I found that I was out in nature as much as I could be. And I was by my creek in my backyard. I was watching the owls that had a nest box on my house, and I started practicing medical qigong outside barefoot. And I noticed something had shifted and everything around me came alive. And I started seeing all the nature in a new way. It was like it was part of my community. Just like I had my human friends, I had these more than human friends. And the longer and the more time you spend in a certain area, you get to know these beings, these trees or the birds, or you suddenly notice that, oh, these squirrels are doing like they're actually coming and communicating with me, or like these crows are sitting above me screeching, telling the other crows, watch out, you know, there's somebody in our space and kind of trying to get me to leave. You start noticing the community and how the community's connecting, and not just with themselves, but with humans too, even though a lot of times us humans are not listening or seeing. So I started taking my coaching clients who I'd been working with mainly in like an office situation. And I realized, you know, I started reading more. So some more articles were coming on board like 4 years ago or so about forest bathing. And I thought I need to start taking groups of people into nature. And so I started something called Elemental Forest Medicine. And I started bringing groups to Lithia Park in Ashland. And maybe sometimes we were two people, sometimes we were six people. And the very first group I did, I was really going on this with my intuition. It was so powerful and potent. The feedback I got from everyone was like, oh my God, this was amazing. People dropped in a very deep way and were able to de-stress and unplug, shut their phones off for 2 or 3 hours. And I was so excited that I saw people who were grieving over different things and in so much stress, and they left that experience in such a calm state and in a happy state. So I registered to take a training with the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy. They're based in Arizona now. They were based in Santa Rosa, California, and probably founded in about 2012. And so I took that training in January 2018. It was a week-long immersion. There were probably 20 of us there. And then from there, I had a mentor and a 6-month practicum I was part of, like a remote practicum. So 6 months later, I became a certified ANFT forest therapy guide.
That's great. Thank you for explaining. I've been looking into the ANFT or Association of Nature and Forest Therapy program as well. It just sounds like a great program and a really like supportive community. And speaking of community, I just loved the way you described the more than human world. And that's so true. You know, if we are open and kind of aware, having that awareness, we start to notice things more. And I've noticed that, you know, when I'm walking around the farm or somewhere, like certain cows will respond a certain way. Like I'm starting to listen to the way they moo and trying to figure out what they're saying to me. Or even like, yeah, the way that the cat is meowing and, you know, is she alarmed or is she excited or is she saying hello? You know, so if we really pay attention, even if we feel like we can't communicate, we are still communicating and other creatures are communicating with us. So you mentioned, I think, Lithia Park. So where do your forest therapy walks take place?
Well, here in Ashland, mostly there at Lithia Park. I have guided some walks and I still plan to guide walks at North Mountain Park Nature Center, which they're two really different places, but they're both quite spectacular. I lived in Boise, Idaho for about 9 months after I became a guide. It was in 2019. And there I guided, there weren't places like Lithia Park right in the city. And I guided at the Idaho Botanical Garden and at the Foothills Learning Center, which was like a kind of like North Mountain Park Nature Center, kind of an education center, but just beautiful area up in the foothills with trees and creek. So there are different ways, you know, it's like a certain sequence for each walk, but you have to look, you know, like really work with the place you're in, because every place can be so different, really a different feel to it.
Yeah. How do you decide on what a good place might be for a therapy walk or for a spathing?
Yeah, that's, yeah, it's part of our training actually to become guides is to how to assess a trail and know, you know, what the best trail is for taking a group of people out. One of the important aspects of determining that is finding a place that's easily accessible for people. So a place that's close into town, people aren't driving out into the wilderness, a place that is really relatively flat and doable for almost anybody at any level. And the actual walk covers usually no more than a half mile. So some people contact me and say, well, I don't know if I can do a hike. And I say, well, this isn't a hike. You know, we're going to be like moving in reverse motion. We'll be going so slow. So the other thing about assessing a trail is finding a place where there's not just narrow trails. Because let's say I have before COVID, you know, I could have 15 people, 12 people. Now with COVID, I'm allowed 10 people total, including myself, in the local parks. But we still need open spaces to spread out, because in between our what are called invitations, our activities that I invite people to take part in, we gather for a sharing circle. And during COVID times, it hasn't always really been a circle. It used to be close. We'd be close together. And now it's more spread out, socially distanced. But there needs to be these open spaces so that, you know, people might be hiking on a trail and we need to have space to be separate. And we can also use some narrower trails for some of the walking invitations, but sometimes there'll be a grove of trees. And in that big grove is a place where I offer certain activities and invitations. So that's really important to have a place where you don't just have one long narrow trail with no place to step to the side.
Yeah, it's helpful that they lead you through the like decision-making process of how to find a good trail.
For each walk, I go out usually 1 to 2 days ahead and I assess what's happening on that trail. So to determine what my invitations will be, like this spring, I've been, you know, looking for, well, what's happening here? What's in bloom? Where are their buds? What's happening that has to do with spring in this area? And I base my walk around what the forest is showing me, what the nature there is doing. So every walk is different. I've had some people come over and over the last few years, and you know, they could not tell you that any walk has ever been the same. They're each different and unique.
Yeah, I have been on two that were in person, and I did one that was like virtual or through the phone or something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, one was when it was pretty warm and it started pouring, and then the other one was frigid cold. There was snow on the ground. So yeah, the one that was, I remember I went to like a Native American Indigenous Cultural Center, back where I'm from in New York State. And they had a forest bathing walk, which I think that was the first one I had ever done. And yeah, I think they thought about like stopping it in the middle because it started pouring, but I actually felt like it kind of, I don't know, it kind of like just gave me a different perspective. And yeah, one of the invitations was to see what we notice. I think that's small and that's calling our attention or something like that. And yeah, I just remember like even amidst the pouring rain, like I was looking at these tiny little insects and just they were kind of going about their business, you know. And I don't know, I just got like, I was sitting down, I had a raincoat on, but I was like sitting there, I was getting all wet, and like I didn't even mind it because I felt like I was so in tune with what was going on and didn't care that it was raining. It ended up stopping raining, and when we came back to the discussion circle, yeah, but that was such a different experience than the one that I did that was in the wintertime. So I was eager to see how the two would compare. But yeah, no, it's definitely a different experience, different days, different seasons, different places. So yeah, I've enjoyed it
a lot.
That's
great. And with each guide, it's different too. And I know, like, sometimes I love guiding in the rain because the forest canopy, like, if I know there might be some rain, I plan the walk to make sure we're in part of the park where there's more of a canopy to protect us. But I remember one time people were at what's called sit spot, this final 20-minute invitation before tea ceremony, and it started pouring and they were all kind of open. And I set up tea ceremony under a really big, I think it was an incense cedar tree. So there was a lot of overgrowth and people were so grateful just to come. You know, the tea ceremony was set up, there was hot tea and there were some sit pads for people to sit on. And we still got wet, but we had a great time. And by the time it ended, you know, we walked back to our cars pretty soaked. And I suggested for everybody to, you know, get home, get in a hot bath or a hot shower. You know, but it does get us humans back into the world that our ancestors lived in, where we were in the elements a lot.
Well, thinking about that and thinking about, you know, feeling the rain on our skin or feeling the temperature and different things, how do sound and other senses play into forest bathing?
Okay, well, that's a really good question because it is... the way we guide through ANFT, the way we're trained, we guide our practice is something called the standard sequence. And after our introduction, the first thing we do is guide our participants through a sensory meditation to help drop us out of our thinking mind and back into our body through our senses. And part of that, too, is also inviting everybody to either leave their phone in the car or have it turned off. So that sensory meditation, I take people through, you know, all the five senses. So, feeling like what are you feeling right now? Like the sense of touch or the sense of smell, the sense of hearing, the sense of seeing, we can get into some imaginal senses, and it's not prescribed in that. I start this meditation based on, you know, we're closing, everybody's invited to close their eyes. And suddenly I'm feeling like a cold breeze on my face or the warm sun on my face. So at that point, I would take people into the sense of touch, you know, what you're feeling. If I started the meditation and there were just these incredible bird calls, I might start with hearing. So it's just, it's different every time. It's what's happening in the forest, which is so cool. So with hearing, one of the things I always let my participants know is that everything is part of the natural world. So even people who aren't on our walk, if somebody walks through a trail and they're carrying a boombox, they're still part of the forest. And I let people know that ahead so people aren't just walking through thinking, oh no, that person has this noisy radio or whatever, which isn't that, I haven't had that ever happen on a walk. But what I'll do is when I'm guiding through that, through the sensory meditation is have people notice what they're hearing in the distance and then what they're hearing in closer proximity, and then bringing those two together and blending them into like this one symphony of sound. And it could be some people will like afterwards when we're sharing, they'll say, you know, I heard some cars on the street and it just sounded like ocean waves, you know, like things, it's so much of it's in our mind too. You know, our concepts can affect how we view things.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you like either how you get people to think in a certain way or like how you encourage people to think about certain sounds, because I've thought of certain human made sounds as rather intrusive. You know, if I'm going out for a walk and I'm OK, I want to just enjoy nature and I want to, you know, listen to the birds or the wind. And then there's a big truck that goes by, like, yeah, it's my inclination to be a little frustrated. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Okay, well, that's, you know, just another sound, and like try to notice where different sounds are.
There's no prescription. You know, it's very, this practice, there's no prescribing. So the way we're trained as guides, the way I've been trained as a guide is to I really let myself channel what the forest is bringing through. And then that comes through my words. Like I might be inviting people to, noticing their sense of smell, maybe inviting them to turn their head to one side and then the other, and noticing if there's a smell that's calling to them. I wouldn't, like, if there was some smell, like something was exotically in bloom, I don't say, smell the lilacs. It's like, what are you smelling? Like maybe turn your head to the right and notice if any smell is calling to you from there, and turning your head to the left and what might be, attracting you in terms of your sense of smell. And I do share things like, it's how the sense of smell is what kept our species alive. It keeps animals alive. They little bunnies, their nostrils flare out and they're smelling to see, where food is, where predators are, where home is. And so I might, mention some of those things as I'm guiding them through the meditation. But there's no like sending anybody out and saying, find a tree and be grateful, show it some gratitude. It's not like that.
Yeah, that's something I really appreciate about forest bathing and forest therapy guides, and just the ANFT program. So I've interviewed another forest therapy guide as well. And just to kind of, yes, see and compare in my own mind, the different responses, and just also too, the different forest bathing sessions I've gone to with different, practitioners or different guides. The different ways that people lead, and what they call attention to, or how they invite the participants to do different things.
Yeah. Let's see. So,
okay. How would you describe the actual forest bathing experience?
Okay. So, it's actually, I would call it, we cross over in the beginning. That sensory meditation helps us cross over a threshold where we're leaving our normal world behind. We've turned off our phones. We're slowing down. We're dropping into our bodies and out of our busy minds that are planning our schedule for the week or planning our grocery list. And sometimes the only way to do that is to slow our bodies way down. So the sensory meditation is part of that. And often after that meditation is over, when people are invited to slowly open their eyes and engage their sense of sight, the whole world around them looks different. And there's a sharing circle we have in between each of our invitations where, as a facilitator, I ask people, what are you noticing? It's not like, what did you notice? It's just, what are you noticing? So it's about teaching people to speak from the heart and listen from the heart. So not planning what you're going to say, but like we used to share a talking piece a sharing piece that would go around, but with COVID people are just picking up their own stick or whatever and speaking. And that part of the practice, that coming together and that openness about being able to share what you're noticing or not share anything, you're totally welcome to not say anything, helps kind of bond the group in a certain way. And after that first sharing circle, after the sensory meditation, we do a practice to slow way down. Some people have a hard time with it. It can seem excruciatingly painful to walk so slowly. People who are hikers and things, like, they're used to moving fast. But it's called What's in Motion, and it's about walking slowly, and I set the pace and noticing what's in motion, what's moving. And then we'll come to the next designated meeting spot and we'll gather. Maybe that walk is like 15 minutes or so. And then we'll share again what we're noticing. And then the next invitations that come after that are called partnership invitations, which means I'm working in partnership with the forest or with the more than human world. So I come up with invitations based on what's happening. Like, there may be some amazing light hitting the creek And the reflections are so amazing. It's like you look down and you see another forest just by looking into the water. So I may invite people to an invitation, maybe it's called water gazing, or an invitation to meet a tree and just to wander out and find it. Notice if a particular tree is calling to you. And if it's not a tree, maybe it's a rock calling to you. And just spend some time with it and, you know, with this being, and notice what happens. You know, so that's being very open, not telling people what to do with that tree. And so there will be maybe a couple more partnership invitations, and we might all stay in one particular grove the whole time after we've walked slowly over there, or we might have some walking invitations in between some of our other invitations, like to get to a different part of the forest. And I always include at the end of a walk or towards the end, a practice called sit spot, where people are invited to find a place to sit and be for about 20 minutes. And when you do this, when you have a spot where you can just be quiet for 20 minutes, the forest, all the animals, the beings around you begin to quiet down also. And when you're sitting there quietly, especially if you have a sit spot, maybe in your yard, or you go to the same sit spot at the park so many times a week, you start noticing things that you've never seen before, like never in years of being in nature. And so people will go do sit spot. And usually while that's happening, I'll be setting up tea ceremony. And then I call and invite people back. And tea ceremony is wild foraged plants or herbs that are all researched, and, you know, I make sure that there's, you know, nothing dangerous, and even for things that, you know, a pregnant woman should not have. I'm really careful about that. And we're trained in that in our training. With COVID, that's changed a little bit during COVID. You know, for a while, I wasn't doing any tea ceremonies or snacks, but the park system here doesn't allow anyone to do wild foraging. So I will wild forage herbs from my, you know, organic plants and trees in my own yard, and bring them and steep the tea. But people come back, and that tea ceremony is a time to kind of integrate what just happened and share. You know, I pour tea for everyone. And during COVID, you know, times I have a community tea bowl, and I pour the tea into the big bowl, and nobody's drinking it, but we're, you know, giving it to, you know, pouring it into the earth in gratitude for what the earth does for us. But, you know, there's typically, you know, when it's not been COVID, you know, people are sitting around in a circle, having snacks, sipping the tea, tasting the forest. So here we're using our senses again. This time we're tasting the forest. And it's a time to come back into our bodies, come back into more socializing, and be ready to go back into our daily life again. So that's kind of a little summary.
Yeah. Thank you. I was thinking about just, the way that sensory engagement really does get us connected with the forest and connected with all the beings around us, and with nature in general. So yeah, like I appreciate the sense of taste too, because I know when I was a teacher, my students always wanted to eat things. and so it's nice when it's allowed, right? And they're like, yeah, you can actually eat this.
Yeah. You know, since COVID, I've been just starting to integrate putting, you know, a little food, like some mandarin oranges that have been cleaned well, and, you know, not touching them, using gloves or something, and, or some packaged RX bars or something, which is really hard for a forest therapy guide to serve anything in a package. It's just, you know, one more thing, you know, that's not nature. But it's, you know, we've had to adapt, and I'm grateful to be able to guide walks here, because some places people still can't gather in public. And I feel that nature is pretty safe as long as we're spread out, you know, socially distanced. And if we are coming close together, we do put masks on.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds.
One thing I wanted to say I didn't really say anything about the specific health benefits of forest therapy, but some of it is, immune support for the cardiovascular and immune systems and the nervous systems, like improving mood, mental focus. I've even read some studies that it can help balance blood sugar levels. But one of the reasons it's called forest bathing in the essence of the forest, is that the Japanese discovered that the trees, specifically conifer trees, emit a chemical called phytoncides. And the phytoncides are like an essential oil from the trees that are part of the tree's own immune system that protect the trees from invaders and fungus and things like that. But those essential oils are floating throughout the forest. They're in the air. And research is showing that people who spend, a certain amount of hours each week, I think it might be 2 hours a week in a forest, their white blood cells, NK killer cells, actually are go up. Tumor fighting cells can actually be at a higher level for people who spend more time in nature, and cortisol levels go down, so stress levels come down.
Wow, that's some compelling evidence. I feel like I've heard so many more cases of cancer and other diseases, as well as stress and mental health, and just lots of other challenges going on. So people need to get out in nature more, and hopefully we can protect the environment so that we can have an environment to go out to.
That's really important. I know more and more people are going to nature because of COVID, and I had found more signs at places like Lithia Park where people are not respecting the land, and had to find parks employees to go clean up certain things or deal with certain things in the park. And so the hope is, yes, that people will discover nature in a new way and develop that love, because what we love, we protect.
Yeah, that's so true. Can you tell us a little about some of the other practices that you guide participants through, like other sensory meditations and Eco Nidra?
Okay. Well, when I guide, occasionally, it depends. If it's a really brisk morning, I may introduce, before we start our sensory meditation, a medical Qigong practice called Qigong shaking, just to get people warmed up and get their energy moving and flowing in their body. And I find it just helps take it helps you kind of release things that you just brought here that you were still thinking about before you got out of your car. So that's one thing I do with people. Sometimes, depending on the weather, I'm great with ice cold water and walking in snow in the winter, that sometimes I will, invite people to take their shoes off and go barefoot in the grass or on the dirt or in the mud to experience what's called earthing, which it helps reconnect us to the planet. And earthing is supposed to really be helpful for the immune system, for the stress hormone, to lower stress hormones and calming. So it's something I try to do every day. And then I'm right now becoming a certified Eco Nidra teacher. And I don't do this on a forest therapy walk per se, but I will be, Eco Nidra comes from the ancient practice called Yoga Nidra, which is known as a yogic sleep. It's a practice for deep, deep rest and stress reduction. And so Eco Nidra, I will be integrating that into things like all day, nature-based retreats with forest therapy, forest bathing, and some Eco Nidra, or a weekend long destination retreat. And Eco Nidra, I'll be doing that actually through Zoom. And once I can start teaching it in yoga centers, when yoga centers are ready to have people back, I will be offering it there. But it's Eco Nidra is a nature-based form of the Yoga Nidra. So it's it helps people also in this deeply restful state connect back in with nature through sound, nature soundscapes.
I feel like my thinking, and I'm wondering other listeners might be wondering this too, like, so if it's deeply restful, are people actually falling asleep, or like, is that encouraged, or is that part of it?
That's a great question. Actually, with Yoga Nidra or Eco Nidra, people get to a place where they're kind of at an in-between place, that you're flat on your back, or you might have your knees up on a mat on the floor with a blanket, or on your, in your bed, or on a couch. And the way you're guided, you might drop off into what is called a yogic sleep, where you're kind of conscious, but you're kind of not. You're in this very deep regenerative type of sleep. Some people do fall asleep. You know, it depends. Like I do about 2 Eco Nidra and sometimes Yoga Nidra sessions a day, just for my own practice. And sometimes if I do it, depending on what time of day I do it, I fall out into this deep, deep place. And then I'm suddenly almost through this 45-minute session and I'm hearing the nature sounds, which come up towards the end. And I'm thinking, oh, what happened? Did I fall asleep? And other times I'm just right there, like mentally, I'm in this deeply relaxed place, but I'm following the facilitated, I'm following the guide who's guiding me in the facilitation. So I would say it doesn't really matter. It's like sometimes you need to fall out in a deeper way, and other times you don't. But either way, there's a sense of rejuvenation when you finish.
It's like either way, you're getting something you need. Like either you're awake enough, right? And you're able to like kind of pay attention in that deep mindful state, sort of. I don't know if I'm using the right words, but or you're getting some restful sleep and like have been led to that place kind of too.
Right. And it's known for really lowering your cortisol levels, really lowering stress levels, and slowing down your heart, which is why people use a blanket, because you can get a little chilly. And also for really activating the alpha brain waves, that changing the brain in a deep way, like, I guess, what is it, maybe 1 hour or one session of Eco Nidra or Yoga Nidra is comparable to like 4 hours of deep sleep.
Whoa. That's awesome.
Yes,
yeah, I've never done that, but I'm intrigued.
I'll keep you posted when I've got my classes going.
Cool. Yeah. Speaking of that, if someone wanted to learn more about forest bathing or the other activities that you've described, where could they go to learn more?
Well, one good place on the web would be natureandforesttherapy.earth. And that is the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy and their website. And they have a lot of information about where, like they have a global guide locator. So you can go to the guide map and get linked to guides from around the world where you could take a walk. You know, you could be guided. They have information on their guide training programs. So that's a good place to go. There's also some really great authors. I would say some really great books would be Your Guide to Forest Bathing by Amos Clifford, who founded the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy. But it's a great book for guiding yourself on a forest bath. And it gives you a real sense of the sequence that we guide, how we do the guiding. There's a new book out called Healing Trees, A Pocket Guide to Forest Bathing by Ben Page. And he was one of my teachers in my training. And he actually has put together the whole curriculum for training guides through ANFT. And I'm really excited to get his book. So Healing Trees, A Pocket Guide to Forest Bathing. There's a book called Forest Bathing, How Trees Can Help You Find Health and Happiness by Dr. Ching Li. And he is probably the most well-known, you know, researcher on trees and health, and chairman of the Japanese Society for Forest Medicine. And there's a lovely book by a forest therapy guide named Julia Plevin. She actually lives in the Ashland area, called The Healing Magic of Forest Bathing. And it's just a beautiful book with incredible photos and just to guiding yourself through forest bathing and the benefits of forest bathing. There's another book I love called Sit Spot and the Art of Inner Tracking. And it's taking yourself on a 30-day challenge to develop your relationship with yourself, with the earth, with others, and the wisdom of our ancestors. And it's by R. Michael Trotta. Those are the ones I would say for forest bathing. And then there's some wonderful nature connection books. Like, I would recommend anything by the author Richard Louv, L-O-U-V, The Nature Principle, about reconnecting with life in a virtual age. And he also wrote a book called The Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. There's a very wonderful book by Florence Williams called The Nature Fix. And she's very humorous and it's so great. It really got me connected to, you know, wanting to be more in nature. There's just so many authors, you know, Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's an indigenous woman and a scientist. And it's a really beautiful book about reciprocity and tending the land and our developing our personal relationship with the land.
Yeah, I'm loving your book list. So two of those have already been ones we've had in our book club recently. So Braiding Sweetgrass we read, and then we also read Last Child in the Woods. So I've jotted down a few more so that hopefully we can either we as a group or I myself can read some of those. But yeah, thank you for all those recommendations.
That's great. There's one more called The Overstory by Richard Powers. Fantastic book. It's fiction, but it's a wonderful book about connecting with nature and humans developing these personal relationships with trees.
Yeah, I have that one on my shelf, but haven't gotten to it yet. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add before you go?
I just would like to say, you know, being a forest therapy guide and, you know, having everything be non-prescriptive, you know, I don't want to say go out, get outside. It's just when you have time, you know, just maybe explore a little bit. You know, what might happen if you went to the park alone? I know that I missed a big part of Lithia Park. I hiked there with friends for decades, and I realized after I really dropped into nature that I'd been missing most of the park, the details. So it's a really beautiful thing to discover, and highly recommended.
What a great place to stop. Thank you so much. And yeah, I'm eager to learn more about your forest bathing and other offerings in the future.
Thanks so much, Ryan, for checking in and inviting me to be part of your show.
Thank you.
That was Song for the Umpqua by Marnie Alberton. Thanks, Marnie, for sharing your music with us. If anyone is listening and would like to share some music for this show, Living Downstream, please email me at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, and I'd be happy to include it, especially if it's environmentally themed. For the last portion of today's episode, I want to share one of the presentations from our recent Eco Innovations Challenge. This was an opportunity for local community members to propose a solution to a local environmental problem or issue.
My name is Rachel Brock. I am going to be a zoology student this fall and also hopefully entomology student as well. I've lived in Oregon for almost all of my life. I really just enjoy the variety and diversity here and all of the ecosystems, and being able to enjoy them and having access to them, I think is really unique and special. All right, so I am presenting the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Project. Our three main concerns, or we have three native species that we are mainly concerned about. The western bumblebee, he is endangered. We have the suckly cuckoo bumblebee, and this one's critically endangered. And then we have our Morrison's bumblebee, and this one is also endangered. So these bees are really important and valuable to our ecosystem. One is because they're very hardy. This means that they're able to fly and keep themselves warm during rain and colder temperatures, which means they have more availability for pollinating than some of our other native pollinators. They're also extremely smart. There was some researchers who did, some UK researchers who did a study with string pulling with bumblebees. And what the study was is that they had little discs that had food in the center and then strings on the end. And the bees were eventually able to pull the food to them using the string and get access to the food in the middle. And then they were later to teach that to other bees in their colony. So they are very smart when it comes to accessing their resources. They also have very long tongues, which means that they are able to reach more diverse flowers and pollinate more of our diverse flowers here. And then the threats that the bumblebees are currently facing, one is climate change. So because temperatures are getting warmer, flowers are starting to bloom at earlier times in the years. The bumblebees don't normally start coming out of their hibernating stages until about June. And because of this, it's kind of putting them into a climate vise, which means they're having to go up to higher elevations to get to flowers that are blooming at their time of year when they're coming out of their hives. And this means, you know, bumblebees can only go so high until there's no flowers available for them with the elevation. And then also, they are having a lack of food supplies because there's not enough diverse flowers and plant species that are continually being planted in our areas. And then there are only a few regulations on allowing different bumblebees and other pollinators into our areas. And most of the time, these pollinators can carry pathogens that native bumblebees aren't used to. And then at-home pesticides, too, are really bad. The strength of the pesticides, if a farmer were to use them, because of the strength of the at-home pesticides, if farmers were to use them on their land, they would have to go to actual college classes and figure out, like, get certifications on how to use these pesticides, because they are so strong and they stay in the plants for up to 7 to 10 years, I believe. And the bees pollinating them can still ingest some of the pesticides from them, and it still hurts them and affects them. Our solution, as an overview of our project, is we are partnering with the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. It's a website that has all the information for uploading data about surveys on bumblebees, as well as it gives us plenty of information and worksheets on how to do the surveys and how to conduct them. I adopted a cell grid for the area that we are going to be using. It will take place on June 12th and 13th. It'll be a two-day workshop. The first day will be the education and DIY, and the second one will be the surveying. I expect there to be about 10 to 15 participants of high school and college students. The museum, or UCC, is the venue we are choosing to do the education and DIY portion. And Susan Applegate, she has some land out in Yonkala area, And we have done some surveying out there for frog eggs before, so we're going to use her property to survey for the bumblebees. And I'm going to outreach for students using flyers, Facebook, talking to their teachers, and to their clubs. So day one is going to be education and conservation. Our education resources will include a PowerPoint that goes over everything you need to know about the bumblebees, as well as the threats they're facing, the conservation efforts that we need to take to help them, and how to conduct the surveys. I'll also give students worksheets so they can follow along throughout the PowerPoint, and I will give them plenty of reading materials so they can continue to also learn about the bumblebees and also have reading material on the surveys as well. And then the DIY portion is the students will build these bumblebee homes. This allows the bumblebees to go inside and gives them an additional place for housing. So bees like to build their nests in like wood piles and in the grass. And there is a lack of habitat for them. And so this will provide additional habitat. And the volunteers can help assist with building these. And day two, the survey that we're going to be performing is a point survey. So a point survey is 45 minutes of searching. You will collect the bee, and when we put the bee into a vial, the vial goes into an ice chest to cool the bees down. This makes it to where they're very sleepy. Then we can take them out and photograph them, ID them, and then send them on their way. For every additional person who helps with the point survey, we will split up the 45 minutes equally of just searching for them. The rapid habitat survey is we will be using the cell grid area that we adopted, and we're going to go over the land, and we're going to be counting the bees that we see, as well as blooming trees, plants, shrubs, and IDing those along the way as well. Volunteers will be able to help students collect the bees. And if students feel uncomfortable collecting them, they are more than welcome to opt out and just do the rapid survey. Students can obtain a certificate for completing both day one of doing the worksheets and learning the education. And then once they're done with the survey, they can get their certification. And that's basically just saying that they came, they got the education, and they were learning about it. And then all the data that we are going to be collecting, which is how many species we're seeing, what kind of plants are around, the elevation, the location, all of that is going to be uploaded to the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas. We will also be getting worksheets off of there to write down all of our data. And then the students will be given additional resources to encourage them to continue surveying after all the project is done. So later continue on, it's the Bumblebee Watch program, and they can they can continue doing citizen science on there. And then here's a schedule of our costs. We'll need 3 insect nets, the milliliter vials, and crushed ice for the surveying portion, the bamboo stakes, panels, and wood glue, finishing nails to create the homes, and a steam kit with a grand total of $189.23. And that is our project.
If you'd like to learn more or get involved with Rachel's project in some way, please email her directly at rachelkyhlyb@gmail.com. This information will also be available in the resource section of the Living Downstream page on the KQUA website.